From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. This week on the show, Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO and chief content officer of the streaming giant that has everyone else playing catch up.
I didn't grow up in this business. I didn't grow up in Hollywood. I'm not a second, third, or fourth generation in this business. I didn't even grow up in this town. So I just think that there's a lot of deeply ingrained cronyism that happens that we never have been a part of.
Sarandos may see Netflix as the ultimate outsider, but the streamer just landed 35 Oscar nominations. Sarandos shares the results of a recent Netflix diversity study and talks streaming wars, the future of theaters, talent relations, data drama, and more. But first on the News Banter, awards shows. Must they go on? Stick around. It's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my buddy and banter, Matt Bellany. Hi, Matt.
Hello there.
So, the Grammys. I know you enjoyed the Grammys because I follow you on Twitter. I actually somehow forgot to watch, which goes to what is going on. The Grammys put on a pretty good show by all accounts, and they dropped more than 50% in terms of ratings from last year. This follows the Golden Globes' much less effective awards presentation. And of course, I will just mention briefly that the Hollywood Foreign Press Association is engulfed in controversy over its failure to have diversity and other practices. But they pulled off a not very good telecast and they saw a 63% decline in ratings. So now we have the Oscars coming and, you know, this is really scary. Is this because it's a strange year with the pandemic and people are somehow detaching from these things? Are people so now connected to their streaming services, as our guest today would be very happy about if it lasts? Is linear TV collapsing? It's got to be unnerving for the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences because we have a year where all the blockbusters were held back and they've been working to include them by expanding categories like Best Picture to get more audience engagement and get more celebrities in the room. And now they're going to have to sail into this thing, having seen what happened to the others and having movies that a lot of people haven't seen, or maybe they saw it on the small screen and it just doesn't land the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I talked to someone over at the Academy. They are freaking out. I mean, these numbers are really, really startling. So the question is, what's going on? I think a couple things that you've alluded to are the main factors here. First, this is not new. There has been a steady decline in linear TV over the past 5 to 7 years. And like everything in the pandemic, things have been accelerated. So I think that what happened over the past year is that people really changed or reassessed their viewing habits. We've seen so many of these new streaming services come on board, like Peacock and Paramount Plus and HBO Max. Every time someone signs up for one of those services, that's time away from linear TV that they're not watching. And it starts to really hit a tipping point, I think, where finally people may go to those streamers first rather than what they might have done before, which is go to linear TV, and if there's nothing on, okay, maybe I'll check out Netflix now. So that's first and foremost. I think there is a broader viewing habit change afoot. Secondly, I think that these events, and sports has also been suffering really big declines this past year. I think these events in the pandemic have lost a bit of their luster. There's no audience, there's no buzz, there's no screaming fans and event type feeling when you watch this stuff. If you watch a basketball game, it's almost like watching a pickup game at Venice Beach. It's not like watching 18,000 fans at Staples Center going nuts over a LeBron three-pointer. It's not quite the same. And I think the ratings are really suffering because of that. If you look at the Globes, this was a terrible broadcast, almost unwatchable. Celebrities via Zoom, technical difficulties, no buzz. You know, you watch the Globes normally and there's people partying at their tables and celebrities hobnobbing. And that's really the fun of these things. And you take that away and it's not there. And even for the Grammys, which had a lot of celebrities, had big talent performing and was really well done for what it was still a lot of acts performing in a giant convention center ballroom that had no fans in it. And the Oscars must look at this and be terrified.
Yes, and adding to the problems that they're facing, China is now saying they might boycott the Oscars. They are mad about Chloe Zhao, who is very much the front runner for Best Picture winner with Nomadland. She made a couple of comments that the Chinese government does not care for. She said, the U.S. is now my country. And this is a long time ago. She talked to a small magazine, a small New York quarterly called Filmmaker Magazine. And she referred to China as a place where there are lies everywhere. I don't think she said anything that wasn't true, but the Chinese government, and what we're seeing is they are using their clout. They also object, I should mention, to an Oscar-nominated documentary short about the Hong Kong protests called Do Not Split. They don't like that one either because they've been suppressing people in Hong Kong brutally, and they don't want that to be called out. And it shows that as these companies globalize, this kind of pressure gets put on them. You know, we've seen other companies trying to avoid conflicts with China. In the case of Chloe Zhao, she has a Marvel movie coming. And the big question from a business standpoint is, does China just decline to play that? And how much? What is the chilling effect that this will have as Hollywood studios and companies try to figure out how to get the most money out of their films and television shows?
Yeah, that's the real problem for Disney, because Nomadland, yes, it could have done a number there. And, you know, they would like the Oscars to play in China. But the Marvel movies are what they really care about. And if the Marvel movie, The Eternals, doesn't get a China release, then that is a real hit to the bottom line. We already saw that the Chinese did not like Mulan when it was released this past quarter. You know, it just didn't perform there at all. It was rejected. And China is in an interesting spot right now because this is all part of a concerted effort to wean themselves off of the American blockbuster movies and to promote their own film industry. This has been going on for a decade. All of these studios fell over themselves to release movies in China because the box office was so gigantic there and it was growing and opening, you know, theater after theater there. But it was all part of a plan for them to learn from the American film industry and then promote their own. And they're now at a place where the movies that are doing well in China are homegrown hits. And that's a big problem for Hollywood. And these other skirmishes coming up are emblematic of a shift that the entertainment industry in America is really going to have to deal with when China becomes self-sufficient and has its own industry and doesn't want to deal as much with the American movies.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure that a lot of people in China want to see American blockbuster movies, but the Chinese government serves the Chinese government. So it may be a big problem for the American companies. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, former editorial director of The Hollywood Reporter. That sound is probably pretty familiar, especially after a year of being stuck inside. Ted Sarandos, the co-CEO and chief content officer of Netflix, has been with the company since 2000, back when the streaming company was sending folks DVDs in red envelopes. I had many questions. First up, we talked about a diversity study of Netflix's U.S.-based programming. Still ongoing, that study is run by Dr. Stacy Smith at USC Annenberg. Sarandos said the idea of hiring someone outside the company to take a look at Netflix's diversity performance came to him about 3 years ago, when some companies were talking about signing pledges to meet certain goals in race and gender.
I didn't want to sign us up for an arbitrary quota. I wanted to commit ourselves to a state of constant improvement. And the only way to do that is to start with the baseline. So we went out to UC Annenberg to do the study. And they basically devised this system where all of the content would be watched by human beings. They would judge the content on 22 measurement points of various forms of inclusion and then let the chips fall where they may. Basically, they looked at all of our English language American produced content from 18 and 19. So we committed to publish the report as soon as it became available and that we would revisit it every couple of years for the next six to come back and see how we're doing against the previous content. And what I'm really proud of, Kim, is that, you know, that content's from 2018 and 2019, which means it was conceived and greenlit, you know, as early as 2015, 2016. You know, it wasn't a flavor of the day initiative. This is something we've been focused on for a long time.
So the good, you had good results. You had gender parity in leading roles, I believe, is one of the points.
Yeah, absolutely. And gender parity in women in leading roles, industry leading in women directing, which is really, I don't think those two facts are disconnected. And similarly, our Black representation on screen exceeded the Black population in the United States, which is good news. And there's other things that were very clear that we have work to do, presenting folks with disabilities on screen, Latinx storytelling, we under-index Latinx population, And we still have some work to do in the LGBTQ representation as well.
The plan now is to invest $100 million over 5 years to basically develop talent. Is that the idea?
Yeah, well, it's an additional $100 million.
I mean, obviously, your overall budget for programming is huge, but yes. you already had initiatives in place. Is that
correct? And this is just this is just developing new voices and new talents. One of the big issues, I think, with inclusion in the entertainment community has been it's a pretty closed network. You know somebody, and that's how you get in. And it's where you went to school. There's a bunch of different things that make it pretty difficult for new voices to be heard. And what we're trying to do is develop programs that put folks in the network. One of the ones I'm really excited about is we have a showrunner program where our producers can nominate candidates to go through this program that's a soup to nuts training program of how to run a television show. And at the end of the process, they ultimately direct an episode of television. So it's a real practical experience that gets folks who are already exhibited deep interest and skill at doing this and gives them a chance.
Which, of course, is huge because, a successful showrunner is probably among the most powerful people in the industry, right?
Right. And they've got people, who are in their writers' rooms, on their productions, who aspire to break in. And this way they have a chance.
Yes. And having decision makers who are buyers is the other, I think the really obviously key thing. It's really been a problem in this industry. Who is at the absolute top of every company? I mean,
but myself included.
Yes. Yes. There's not one that isn't run by a white man, right? Like at the absolute top. And then you get down and you start having some women and people of various different colors, but not a whole ton.
Yeah, I agree. And I do think it's important that my creative content team has to reflect the world that we're serving. And they're more likely to hire directors and creators who look like the world that we're serving. And that who's behind the camera has a lot to do with who's in front of the camera. Who's in the executive suites has a lot to do with who's behind the camera. So I think it's ongoing work that we've been working on from the beginning. And I think, perhaps, Kim, our outsider nature gives us the ability to do this better than others. I didn't grow up in this business. I didn't grow up in Hollywood. I'm not a second, third, or fourth generation in this business. I didn't even grow up in this town. So I just think that there's a lot of deeply ingrained cronyism that happens that we never have been a part of.
Yes, it's been a very clubby community here.
Yeah, yeah.
Certainly in the upper echelons, very clubby.
Yeah, I think that's, and I'm sure that's not unique to the entertainment industry, unfortunately, but the entertainment industry has the same issue.
And it's an interesting industry in that there is, up until more recently, there have just been a very few, small number. It's like more exclusive than the Senate, the people who have power in Hollywood, It's a few people at a few companies who have ultimate power. And I don't know that many businesses where it's so concentrated as, true, legacy kind of power.
Yeah. And I think if you dig deeper, our teams at Netflix have unprecedented green light authority. So I have directors who work at Netflix who have more green light authority than the president of a network or a president of a studio. So it's not just important that you have the people in your employ, you also have to distribute the power to them. And there was a very practical driver of that, which is when we're moving at the speeds that we're moving and that the number of projects that we're doing around the world, people have got to have decision-making authority. And then holding them accountable for their decisions is pretty unique to the business. So and I do think that the people who work at Netflix who inbound these projects have the ability without a green light committee, without having to run it up the flagpole, to say yes. And I think it's really what's driven a lot of those results that came out of that study.
Are you doing this because you're good citizens, or is it because it's good business, or do you get the combo platter?
It's definitely a combo platter. I think it's really good business. It's clearly that people want to see themselves reflected on screen. And again, I think that starts with the organization itself. And what I'm incredibly proud of is, half of our leadership team are women at Netflix. Half of our leadership team are people from underrepresented communities. Our films are 23% directed by women, 25% written by women, which is fantastic. And what's really cool is our most successful film of all time, Bird Box, directed by a woman, Suzanne Beer, the great director, and one of our more successful films in 2020, which was Old Guard, directed by a woman of color. And these are big action movies. So it's important to not think that women make a certain kind of movie, or a director of color makes a certain kind of movie. They make the movies that people want to see, and they're really great at it. That's real opportunity, I think.
I have so many things I would like to ask you about, but I'm going to do that right now. I guess I'll start with the streaming wars. You guys have moved, I think. I mean, in the early days, there was no sort of hesitation. We are not doing theatrical release unless it's day and date. It seems like that is changing, along with maybe some other things, as you've gotten to know Hollywood, maybe, and Hollywood's gotten to know you. Am I seeing that right?
Well, it's not that we changed. Our core is we make movies for our members. And the only thing I ever objected to theatrical releasing of our films was the theater owners would require a very long window of exclusivity to have access even to a single screen. That's what I was reacting to, which is I did not want to hold back a movie for 200 million fans around the world so I could show them in a single theater in New York or in LA for a week. That to me was the big disconnect. And I don't think that consumers who are looking for a great film to watch are really thinking about where it was first. They're just looking at, is this a film I care about? So when we invest in those films, you know, as if people are going to watch them, not necessarily if they're in a theater, that's fine. If they're not, it's just that long window of exclusivity that we were basically saying I didn't want to participate in.
And now?
Look, we've been able to gradually work through those things. And even in the pandemic, Midnight Sky has played on about 800 screens around the world. And now, as you see, because out of necessity, people are more flexible and creative about windowing from day and date to 17 days to 30 days. All those things are positive for consumers. But in general, our core business model is to deliver our films for our members. If we can put them in screens to give them the opportunity that if they want to go out this weekend and they want to see that movie, that they can do that. That's a great thing, as long as we can, you know, do that in a way that doesn't interfere with the core business.
Can you give us some sense of, well, could we be comfortable with this many screens for this long? Or, you know, we're seeing the windows, the legacy studios, they obviously are breaking the window and the number seems to shift depending on who you're talking to.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think, look, it's a conversation that I'm glad to have with you, but it's a conversation that I'm can assure you no movie lover is having. People just want to watch movies and they just want new movies and they want to have access to them. And most people don't even have a theater in their neighborhood.
Filmmakers care though, right? It's the passion of the filmmaker.
And I'm not trying to stand in the way of that. We're trying to enable it as much as we can. You know, we bought the Egyptian Theater in LA and we bought the Paris in New York so that we would make sure that we'd have access to it even if other folks who controlled screens wouldn't give it to us. But, you know, that's not a big scalable answer. But I do think that it's, you know, most people watch most movies at home. And I do think that going out is a very different experience. And seeing the movie on a big screen is a great, I miss it terribly. And I hope it all comes back healthy. And I hope that I can have those opportunities to get back into theaters, both for our filmmakers and for film lovers like me.
I do wonder about the sustainability because, you know, if you don't support theaters at a certain point, it collapses and we may be close to that point. What are your thoughts on that? You know, especially with Warner's going day and date, you know, there's a school of thought that maybe they'll suffer at the box office when they try to get that money coming in. And then there's another school of thought, which is the future and it's not theaters.
I think you've got to follow the audience. And if the audience isn't showing up and they're showing up watching at home, you got to adapt. I think seeing a movie in a theater, like I said, is a really incredible experience. And it might just be that it becomes rarer. It's a very hard thing to figure out what the kind of post-pandemic behaviors and how they shift. You know, there's a big financial infrastructure required to support screens that have to ultimately be supported by the fans and by the viewers.
Do you think the legacy studios are going to be harmed by trying to preserve, you know, their theater business, which costs so much to market and so on, while trying to stream at the same time, which in the streaming, as you know, it's almost like I always say it's like the plant in the little shop of horrors. Feed me, master, I'm hungry, getting more and more demanding. You have a clear, you know, this is what we're doing. This is our business. They are trying to do two things, it seems.
You know, when businesses change, when consumer behavior changes radically, how you navigate those waters is so hard. You know, you might say that not being diversified in our business approach is a challenge, but it's actually been such a blessing that we've not had to try to save a business. And I think that once your primary role is trying to save a business, you're dead. Because, and even remember, we made the transition from DVD to streaming. We never spent a minute trying to save the DVD business. our future was always going to be in streaming, and any energy we spent trying to save the DVD business was energy that wasn't being spent trying to create the streaming business. So I just,
we still have it though, right? You still have the DVD. Yeah.
There's a few people out there. And I think in general, like I said, it's, you know, it's domestic only. It's very small, and it's probably for folks who don't have very fast broadband in some pockets of the country. But in general, I'd say, you know, our core business has been to grow the streaming business. And then if we had engineering resources that were working on DVD, that means they weren't working on streaming. If we had marketing dollars that we're putting into DVD, that means we're not putting it into streaming. And I do think that is putting the consumer first was really important. Once you see that happening, you've got to go all in.
Coming up after a short break, Ted Sarandos defends that Netflix habit of reporting how many people watched 2 minutes of a show. You're listening to The Business from KCRW. This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to Ted Sarandos, the Chief Content Officer and co-CEO of Netflix. The streamer scooped up 35 Oscar nominations last week, far and away more than any competitor. Next in line was Amazon with 12, followed by Legacy Studios, Disney, and Warner Brothers with 8 nominations apiece. Maybe it's the pandemic bump, but we don't have a clue how many people watched Mank or The Trial of the Chicago 7. Netflix can harvest very precise data about who watched what for how long, but they don't share that precious information publicly. Now, in terms of data, we've been talking to the head of the WGA. Feels like data is going to be a looming battle. I mean, we had Jason Blum on the show. He talked about it. George Clooney said he was happy with the data you gave him.
And by the way, Jason Blum got the same data that George did. So I don't know what that was about.
Go figure. Do you know that you have a sort of a date with the destiny in terms of data? Or are you? No.
No, look, you know, you've seen us. We've become much more open and transparent. We've become completely open and transparent with our producers and increasingly transparent with the public. When we were the only ones doing this, it was very hard, you know, to have apples and apples comparisons on the data. So we didn't want to be like just blanket publishing everything because there was no context. People didn't know what that means. So you think about Live plus 7 TV, their entire business model is focused on eyeballs on the screen in that time frame. So it's a fair thing to measure them on the date of the broadcast and plus a few days because they're probably selling ads for something that's happening that weekend, you know, like selling a movie ad on Thursday night. How that thing performed on Thursday night is hugely relevant to advertisers and to people who track that business. Now, ultimately, culturally, it wasn't as relevant at all because people were watching those shows for a long time. So we're looking at it as saying, you know, what's the cultural relevance? And this is the kind of first 28-day viewing that we talk about on Netflix as having, you know, some cultural relevance to the press and to the folks who read it. And for the people who make the content, they want a little more level of detail. And we do share that level of detail with them as well because we think it helps them become better connected to our audiences. We're not trying to hide anything by not being transparent. We're just trying to position it when streaming is more and more the norm. I think that there'll be some uniform way of looking at data.
Yeah, that people who watch 2 minutes thing didn't land for people like me. You're like, okay.
So it's very representative of the viewing.
You mean it extrapolates from there?
Yeah, we found that it was a very representative extrapolation of the viewing.
Now, in terms of talent mega deals, you know, you've taken some blowback on some of them, and some of them seem to have worked out magnificently. Are you just like, we throw the dice when we like a talent?
Yeah, look, we kind of foresaw a day when most of our suppliers were going to be competitors in some form. So access to talent is very important. There's a long history of these overall talent deals with Warner Brothers and ABC and Disney and others. And we had in the past have been able to have them make shows for us under the terms of those deals. And increasingly, what we kind of predicted would come true did come true. And those studios did not want to offer us those programming anymore.
They finally figured that one out. Yes.
Yeah.
It took them a while.
Yeah. So I would say that, you know, those talent deals were just a way to make sure we had access to the greatest creators on the planet. And so it wasn't like we chose to do this and we could have done it otherwise. That's just the way the business worked. Now, I don't know that it will always be that way because I think there's something great in having the flexibility to work all over town if you want. And I just think what's happening now is that through those studio overall deals is that they don't have the ability to work all over town anymore. But in general, where we sit right now, that was the way to do business with the greatest storytellers in the world. And I've been super thrilled with those relationships. And I do think you have to look at them over a very long window. You can't look at it and say, hey, you did this deal a year ago. What happened? This is IP development that takes several years and very long to come to screen. And then after that has a long tail of the IP that was developed during that time.
Yes. When you look at the landscape now, who makes you the most, I wouldn't say nervous because I don't think you're nervous, but who do you think is really, do you think, I don't know if you're willing to address this, but I'll ask, I've heard people who are veterans of Warner Media say they don't believe that they will be able to spend or willing to spend, people talk about NBC Uni merging or buying some kind of deal with Warner Media. What do you see? Can you forecast a little for us?
No, certainly I can't forecast it. I could just tell you that we're acting as if this was going to happen. One thing that's for sure is it's a competitive landscape. It's competitive for members. It's competitive for talent. But I'll tell you, I've been very impressed with the entries. I think obviously the rapid growth of Disney Plus has been commendable. I think HBO Max is a fine product. I think Discovery Plus is a very impressive entry. And the fact that you see how they basically take their networks and turn them into Barker channels for their streaming service now. And I think all of these different things will lead to more cord cutting, more hours of watching in on-demand platforms. So the linear television world becomes a little more hobbled and the direct-to-consumer streaming on-demand universe becomes more robust. So that's a good thing.
So you were obviously doing massive expansion around the world, and some of it is just, works every... White Tiger, I think, is a film that works for a global audience, as you have seen, right? And we had the filmmaker on, and he talked about how grateful he was that, he didn't think that anybody was making this movie a few years ago, and now you guys are.
And by the way, we've been watching him since Man Push Cart. He's an amazing director. But, we've been growing phenomenally around the world, and our business is becoming more, and it will become more international than it is domestic over time. And what's been really, really encouraging and exciting is the global reach of content from anywhere in the world. One of our most successful shows is La Casa de Papel. In the US, it's called Money Heist. It's in Spanish. We shoot it in Spain. It's basically a show for the Spanish-speaking world, but people watch it in enormous numbers everywhere in the world, including in the United States. So when Bong Joon-ho won the Oscar for Okja was my movie, for Parasite,
yes.
He basically made this reference to Americans need to get over the one-inch wall, which he meant subtitles.
Yes.
We've been
right.
seeing that happening at Netflix for years, including making Okja with Bong a few years ago, which was a very global film from Korea. Just in the last couple of months, Lupin from France, it's been our most successful non-English language series launched on Netflix to date. But we have hundreds of original shows in local languages, filmed with local producers and local storytellers all over the world. While we're doing all of this that we're all tracking and talking about, in the middle of award season, we're growing a real global streaming business that's creating content from everywhere in the world for everywhere else in the world. And that's been an incredible joy to see that come together.
Ted Sarandos is the co-CEO and chief content officer of Netflix. And thank you so much for making time to talk to us.
Thanks for having me, Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with help this week from Desmond Taylor. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.